Yes, so the theme of this retreat is the Bodhisattva ideal. And what is a Bodhisattva? A Bodhisattva is somebody whose energies flow into all the different things, all the different directions that make a positive difference to the lives of other living beings. That's where the energies of a Bodhisattva are going. That's the main thing in his or her life. That's all that matters. So I thought I'd have a look at this historically. Who was the first Bodhisattva? Who was the first Bodhisattva? Well, you might think the first Bodhisattva was Siddhartha Gautama, the man who became the Buddha. But according to Buddhist tradition, this is not true. The first Bodhisattva was a small furry animal, a soft animal, a wild animal, a hare. So according to Buddhist tradition, this was the beginning, maybe the beginning, of the many lives of the Buddha that led up to his final life when he gained enlightenment. And there is a reminder of the greatness of this animal, because after all, this animal must be a very great animal if he is the first Bodhisattva. And this reminder is found in a strange place. It's found in the sky. It's found in the full moon. So this is where the title of this talk comes from, The Hare in the Moon. Now, this may be a problem already, because it may be that when you look at the moon, you can't see the hare. Unfortunately, the moon is not in the sky at the moment, and in any case, at the moment, the moon is just a very thin crescent. So I've brought along a picture of the moon. Here you are. So this is a photograph of the moon. I know you probably can't see it all that well from there. So can you see the hare now? what do people see when in Sweden? What do they see when they look in the moon? What do they?
A man in the moon.
A man in the moon. It's the same in England, actually. They talk about the man in the moon. So can you see the man in the moon? Sometimes I think I can see like two eyes, one eye here, and a mouth down here. Maybe that's like the face of the man in the moon. Maybe. It's not a very good man, I don't think, anyway. Have a look at this one, then. This is a drawing that somebody's done on the same, not exactly the same photograph, but a very similar photograph, but a bit darker. So that's way up. So if I turn it like that. Now, I think there may be an American influence in this drawing because the animal is holding an Easter egg. But I don't know if you can see. No, I think that should be right, yeah. It is quite... Come and have a look afterwards if you want to see if you can see it. I'll tell you what when I first looked at this, what I could see actually was more like, a little bit like this, but I could see the hare leaping, jumping over, and this blob down here, and maybe later in the talk we'll see what this blob is, because I don't think it's really an Easter egg. So I saw the hare leaping across like this. Now, it's interesting that... that's a good idea. I could put these on the... It's interesting that the man in the moon is not a very common idea. The hare in the moon is a very common idea, and in most cultures, they see a hare in the moon. You know what a hare is? Hara. So people in India, China, Tibet, Southeast Asia, Africa, Mexico, and also the native tribes of North America, and even my ancestors, I don't know about the Celts and the Saxons in Northern Europe, they all talk about the hare in the moon. The man in the moon is quite a recent idea. And the hare is very, very important and is very often associated with the moon in folklore in Europe as well as other parts of the country. This is a woodcut from England of a hare. And this one is, it's a bit difficult to see again, but this is from China, a Chinese picture, and in the moon you see the hare, and the hare is actually pounding rice in this picture. So the Chinese thought they could see. It's funny, what if you look at something like the moon, which is a bit fuzzy, it's amazing what pictures you can make out, like making out the constellations of the stars, isn't it? You say, oh, look, over there there's a crown, over there there's a woman sitting. It's amazing. Anyway, so that's the hare in the moon. So what is it about the moon? What is so special about the moon? Well, the light of the moon is soft. It's changing. It's rising up in the night, in the darkness. Also, the moon is pulling on the world, isn't it? Making the tides, guiding the natural cycles. And I think many people, many men and women, feel that they're called by the moon. When the moon is full, it's an amazing feeling. That you sort of, when the sun comes up, you just, oh, it's a nice sunny day. But when the moon comes up, you think, oh, the moon is so beautiful. And it's changing all the time. It's reflected in the rivers, reflected in the pools. That's another amazing experience when you see the moonlight coming out. It's born as a very thin moon, and it grows bigger, then it grows smaller, then it dies. So the cycle of the moon, of all the cycles we experience, is probably the most obvious of all the cycles. And so therefore it becomes a symbol for anything that is cyclical. And there is a traditional Buddhist fable of how the hare got into the moon. And in Buddhism, the moon becomes the symbol for the bodhisattva. And so on Buddhist tankas, you'll often see a sun and a moon. The sun for the Buddha, the moon for the bodhisattva. On your way out, if you look at the Wheel of Life, you'll see the same. The sun and the moon are in the sky, above the monster that holds the Wheel of Life. And the sun is the Buddha. Why is the sun the Buddha? Because the sun is constant light. It's as if it's represents enlightenment that is just always shining, awareness that is always there. But the moon is more interesting because the moon grows, the moon changes, and the bodhisattva is not yet fully enlightened. The bodhisattva is on the way to enlightenment, and so the moon is the symbol for the bodhisattva. But more than that, well, especially if you imagine yourself living in a very hot country like India, the sun can seem a little bit fierce, a little bit angry. But at night, the moonlight feels so cooling. Yeah, in fact, there's an idea in India even that the moon itself cools you down if you stand in the moonlight. So the sense of the moon being like kindness and compassion is very strong in a hot country. And so therefore it's associated with the bodhisattva ideal. Now, this idea of the hare being in the moon, go back to the picture again. The stories talk about how the hare got there. How did the hare get there? And in the most popular of all Buddhist stories in the East is the story of how the hare got into the moon. The story of the hare as a previous life of the Buddha, which is called a Jataka story, the hare Jataka. And it's probably the most often told story in the Buddhist countries, in China, in Sri Lanka, in Thailand, even in Tibet, and all these places, this story is told all the time, to children and to adults. So I'll try and tell you the story of how the hare got into the moon. So you have to get yourself as if you've been tucked up in bed by your mother, and she's going to tell you a nice fairy story, and that'll help you sleep and you have lovely dreams, okay? So don't take it too literally. Remember, this is a fable. In fact, the way it starts is, well, in the darkest and remotest depths of the past, when animals could speak and human beings could take on the appearance of animals. So you know this is a long time ago. Human beings could take on the appearance of animals. In those days, a young hare lived in a clearing in the forest. And I think of this forest as being like this, the forest on the island here. The only difference is that in the forest where the hare lived, there is a river running through the forest. And the most amazing thing happened last night, because while Arieka was explaining about the retreat in Swedish, I was getting a bit distracted and I was looking out of the window because I couldn't understand the Swedish. And I looked out of the window and along this road a hare came running along. It was definitely a hare, not a rabbit. And he stopped just outside here. It was about 8 o'clock, maybe, or half, or quarter past eight, so getting a little bit dark. You just stopped, looked in through the window, and then you went on again. And there's something about hares. They're very strange animals. Very strange animals. And, I mean, this, I've never seen a hare in Sweden before, and I've never seen a hare so close to a building before. I've seen them often in England. So we imagine this forest where the hare is living, just like this forest here. Maybe there is a mountain behind the forest, though, big mountain behind the forest. There's the stream, and not far away there's a small village, a lovely spot here. Now, living in the forest, there are a number of animals living with the hare. They're all friends of the hare. And in fact, there are three special friends that the hare has got. An otter, yeah. A jackal. Do you know what a jackal is? Like a dog, wild dog. And a monkey, yeah. So these are the three special friends of the hare. An otter, utter. Utter, is that right? You know, an animal lives in the water, catches fish, yeah. Now, the hare was sort of the leader of these animals, and he was very keen on spiritual practice. And he wanted them all, in particular, to practice generosity and to celebrate special days. And the special day was coming up. The next day was the full moon day. And in India and many cultures, of course, the full moon is when you do a whole day. You have a whole day devoted to spiritual practice. And the same is true in many Buddhist countries. The full moon day is when you spend your whole day practicing spiritually. So he called a meeting. He said, okay, let's get together. What are we going to do? Tomorrow, full moon day, what are we going to do? The best spiritual practice is generosity. What can we do? And, well, they had something going in their favor, which was because the forest was so beautiful and so quiet, when people wanted to come and meditate, they would come to the forest. They knew it was a good place to meditate, very quiet, very pleasant place, the lovely sound of the river. So they said, okay, look, I know what we can do. If somebody comes here to meditate, we could make sure they can stay here for as long as they want by providing them with food. Yeah? That seems a good thing to do, doesn't it? That would be a really good way for us to practice generosity. So they all go off to look for food. So what can they find? Well, the otter, this is obvious. The otter, by the way, he's very, he's a little bit arrogant, the otter, I think, in this story. So you have to imagine a very arrogant otter strutting off into the water. And he thinks, what is the best food of all? Fish. Fish is the best food of all. And he smells some fish, and he finds some fish. These fish are dead. In fact, they're rather a little bit rotten, these fish. That's how you can smell them, because they are very, very smelly. Sorry?
It's a Swedish delicacy.
Yes, maybe that's what it is, yeah. And he finds them buried in the sand. A fisherman had left them there, and he'd buried them in the sand. And he says, doesn't say this very loudly, but he says, does anybody own these fish? And of course, the fisherman's miles away, so nobody answers. So the otter is able to take the fish, and he goes back to to where the animals are going to meet. He said, that's good, I have this food, you know. Okay, what about the jackal? Now, the jackal is a very cunning, very crafty animal. And so the jackal thinks, I'm going to go to the village. There's loads of food in the village. I can find something there. And he slinks around the village, and he looks in the huts, and eventually he finds a hut, and there's nobody in the hut. The hut is empty. And he looks inside the hut, and inside he finds two things. These are very strange things to find in a hut, but I have to be accurate to what the story says. He finds a yogurt pot full of yogurt and a dead iguana. An iguana is a kind of lizard, yeah? So he says this without raising his voice too much. He says, does anybody own these? And nobody says so. So the yogurt pot has a string round the neck. So he puts the string round his neck, over his head. He stuffs the iguana in the yogurt pot, and he trots back down to the forest. Now he has some food, yeah? Now the monkey, we have to imagine, you've got the otter is very arrogant. The jackal is very cunning. And the monkey is very lazy. So we have to imagine this dreamy monkey. Now, he's got no problem at all. He's up the tree. He's in a mango tree. So the tree is full of mangoes. So he doesn't even bother to pick them. He says, well, if anyone comes along, I'll give him a mango. There's no problem, you know. And they all think to themselves, all these three animals, they think, how virtuous I am. I've got my generosity all set up. If anyone comes here to meditate, we can feed them. No problem at all. So what about the hare? So, okay, the jackal thinks yogurt iguanas is the obvious thing to give people. The otter thinks fish is the obvious thing to give people. The monkey thinks fruit is the obvious thing to give people. What does a hare eat? The hare eats grass. So his first thought is, okay, I'll give him some grass. I'll get the lawnmower out, I'll give him some grass. But the hare is not stupid, and he thinks, actually, if I'm honest with myself, I know that no meditating human being coming here is going to want to eat grass. Humans do not eat grass. And he's very, very sad, very upset when he thinks this. And he becomes into despair in a way. And he says, no sesame, no beans, no rice have I as food to give. And he starts to cry. And then he has this really strange idea. And he thinks, the best food for somebody wanting to meditate is probably roast hare. This is what he thinks to himself, is probably roast hare. So he's very excited at this idea, apparently. He's very excited and really pleased. He's at last he's thought what he can do. And he says, all I need is a fire, and then I can give anyone who comes along here, I can give them some roast hare, no problem. Now, meanwhile, there is a god. And this isn't like the Christian god, this is just one of the old Indian gods. So you imagine a little bit like Zeus in the Greek pantheon. And this god's name is Shakra. And he's the king god, and he sits on a throne. And he's sitting there rather dreamily. It's a marble throne he's sitting on. You know, marble, a white rock, right? White rock. So he's sitting on this throne, and as he's sitting there, according to the story, the throne starts to get hot. And he notices it getting warm. Let's turn the central heating down. And it gets hot, and eventually the throne gets so hot, he can't sit down anymore. And he goes, ouch, he has to stand up. And he thinks, what is going on? Why is my throne getting so hot? It gets red hot. And apparently, this impulse for self-sacrifice from the hare is what made the throne get hot. There was some reason that connects this great impulse. So Shakra discovers what the hare has decided to do, but he's a little bit cynical, and he thinks, well, it's all very well him having this idea, but I wonder if he really will do it. I mean, what if nobody turns up? Says, I know what I'll do. I'll disguise myself as a meditator, and I'll turn up, and I'll see whether he can really fulfill this idea he's got. Okay, so the next thing that happens is this skinny old sage, this skinny old meditator, which is really Shakra in disguise, hobbles into the wood, a wandering ascetic. And he goes in, and as he goes through the wood, he says, oh, how can I do my meditation? I'm so hungry. How can I possibly meditate? I'm so hungry. So the first person he meets is the otter, of course, down by the stream. And the otter says, I'll read out the. There are little poems in the story, the original. But these Jatakas, by the way, they were told for many generations orally. And then eventually they were written down about nearly 2,000 years ago, the Jatakas were written down. And some people say that the form the Jatakas are in is even earlier than most of the Pali Canon. So they're very early records of Buddhist teachings, these old stories of the previous lives of the Buddha. And they contain little poems. So the otter has these rotten fish, and he picks the rotten fish up, and he says, okay, have these rotten fish. And he says, seven red fish are mine, brought to land from out of the flood. Wanderer, eat your full fill and stay within this wood. So the ascetic looks at the fish, says, oh, they're very smelly. He says, it's very kind thought, but I think not. All the same to you. So he goes on a little further, and then he meets the sneaky jackal. And he says, oh, I'm so hungry, I can't meditate, I'm so hungry. And the jackal says, that's okay, I've got plenty of food for you. Look, a dead iguana. In a pot of yogurt. And the sage, he said, well, it's a very kind thought, he says, but I don't think I'll have that. No, I don't think so. So it goes on a little. Well, actually, I'll give the verse. This is the verse. An iguana and a yogurt pot, the villager's evening meal, a spit to roast the flesh withal, I cunningly did steal. These are mine to give, O wanderer, eat, I pray, if you should deign within this wood a while with us to stay. So that's his poem. And then we get the lazy monkey just up on the branch. He doesn't even bother to come down. And he says, look, here's an overripe mango. The mango is very soft and sticky, you know. And the man says, I'm not so sure about that. But the monkey, this is the monkey's poem. My icy stream, my mango ripe, my pleasant greenwood shade. Enjoy them all if you would dwell content in forest glade. It's interesting, they all of them, they're very keen to say, this is mine, you can have it, even though they nicked it, really. So the man says, no, he doesn't want the dripping mango. So he goes on, then he meets the hare. In the very middle of the wood, there is a clearing. In the middle of the clearing, there is sitting the hare. And the hare is very happy and excited when this wanderer comes along. So, oh, I'm so hungry, I can't meditate. And the hare says, nor sesame, nor beans, nor rice have I as food to give, but take my roasted flesh and in the forest live. He says, you shall banquet on my flesh. It'll be very delicious. But the wanderer says, no, I can't do that because I can't kill, can I? You know, I've taken precepts, I can't kill something. And the hare says, no, that's no problem. You just build a fire and I'll jump in the middle of the fire, see? So the wanderer builds a nice big bonfire, lights the fire. When it's a really good blaze, the hare is about to jump in. And then, according to the story, he says, hang on a minute, there are my fleas. So he shakes off all his fleas so they don't get burnt, because he doesn't want to cause any problems to other living beings. And then he leaps into the middle of the fire. So this is him leaping. And I think this is the fire here, you see. He's leaping into the fire. Very, very strong image, really. And it says, he lands like a royal swan alighting on a cluster of rosy lotus blossoms. So he's there in the flames licking all around him. But after a while, he sort of puts his head up and he thinks, this is a very cold fire. It's not working. And he sort of completely says, your fire is useless, he says, the wanderer, it's not working at all. And this, of course, is the point where the wanderer, the old bent old man, can reveal his true identity as Chakra, the king of the gods. And he becomes huge. So he becomes huge. So, I am Chakra, king of the gods. I was testing you. The hare is very angry, annoyed about this, being tricked in this way. He's standing, imagine the hare standing in the middle of the fire. saying, you stupid man, what are you doing this to me for? But Chakra says, look, I am so impressed by your genuine self-sacrifice that I'm going to make sure that people never forget. And so what he does, according to the story, is he goes to the nearest mountain, which is a volcano. He's very large at this point. He takes the mountain up and puts it under his arm and squeezes it like this. And I don't know if you've ever done this thing in cooking, where you maybe put icing around the edge of a cake. You have a bag full of the icing and you squeeze it around and it comes. So he does the same with a volcano because he's very big and strong. And what is his cake? His cake is the moon. So using volcano juice, he draws on the moon the picture of the hare. Which is what we can still see to this day. So that's the end of the story. And at the end of the story, the Buddha is telling this story of a former life, and he says, I remember that place, I remember that forest, because I was the hare many, many thousands of lifetimes ago. And you'll see this, as I told you, it's told as a story many, many times in Buddhist literature and to children and adults. And it's also depicted many times. Again, you may want to come and have a look at these later, but this one is from an old Indian stupa, very ancient Indian stupa, maybe 2,000 years old, and it shows the hare jumping into the fire. And if you look carefully, you can see also the jackal, the monkey, the otter is there somewhere as well. And the old man, the ascetic, is here. And there's another one here, which is damaged, also from an old stupa. But you can again see the hare jumping here, jumping into the flames of the fire. So if you ever see an old Indian Buddhist stupa or something like that, have a look, and you may well find a depiction of the hare Jataka, because it's such a well-known story. So anyway, there's the story. Okay, well, I mean, there's a nice story. It's a nice story. But what do you make of it? Does it have any useful meaning in it, I suppose? Of course, there are a lot of things assumed in it. For example, because it's a traditional Indian, traditional Buddhist story, it assumes the idea of rebirth. It assumes the idea of many previous lives. And this was, in a way, the Buddha's way of telling stories. He would often tell stories of animals and strange people doing strange things. And he would tell it saying, I remember this from many thousands of years ago. And I think we can see this partly as a way of showing interconnectedness. And we may think of this more in terms of having an empathy, an interconnected feeling with animals and with people. And the way that they used to do it in ancient Buddhism would be to talk in terms of rebirth. The Tibetans still do today. They'll say, if you think about it, with all the many generations of rebirth, everybody has once been our own mother. So we should feel the same feeling we have towards our mother. At its best, when we like her, we should feel that towards everybody. So it's a very good way of getting an idea of interconnectedness. But of course, that's assuming that you have a sense of rebirth, and not everybody does. Some people, it's quite natural to think in terms of rebirth, but others, it's not. And so the Buddha would teach through these stories of previous lives, these Jataka stories. And he'd think of stories that he felt were relevant to particular people and to particular people's needs. So in this case, he taught this story because he thought it was relevant as a teaching method. And the hare is maybe the best known of these stories. So in a way, the hare is one of the most famous animal heroes in the world. And each of these stories, they have something in common. They always show how someone can develop a particular quality which leads to a higher state of consciousness, a more free, a more expanded state of consciousness. That's what the story is always for, the Jataka story. And they also show how somebody can influence other people or other animals for the good through their example and leadership. And they show how each of the little lessons that they learn moves them closer to Buddhahood. In this case, by practicing dana, by practicing generosity in an extreme form. So in a way, it's obvious, just as a story of supreme self-sacrifice, and we're supposed to be reminded of this self-sacrifice every time we see the hare leaping across the moon. So it's quite good just to be captivated by the story, as if you were being told by your father or your mother at night, and you listen to the story, and you go to get bed, and you have your dreams, you know. Not thinking about it too much. Obviously there are questions, as rational people, we would ask, well, is it really true that in the old days animals could talk to each other? Are you sure that's true? You're not trying to fool me, are you? Although you might say, what about jackals and hares? A jackal would never make friends with a hare. The jackal would be chasing the hare. The hare would be running away from the jackal. No, I don't believe it. And then surely no sensible person would keep their iguana in a yogurt pot. I don't believe it. It's not sensible. It's not reasonable. Or also, wasn't the hare being rather extreme? Isn't this rather an extreme thing to do, to try cook yourself for food? It's rather a waste of your life doing that, isn't it? After all, what if we find here that we didn't have enough food, the cooks didn't bring enough food for Saturday meal, you know? Would you say, oh, it's okay, I'll jump in the oven. I can be the food tonight. I wouldn't do that. I don't know if you would. But if you would, make sure that you eat plenty beforehand so that you've got lots of flesh on you. But I will say a little bit about the story anyway. The generosity of the other animals is a little bit suspect. It's not quite believable. The otter and the jackal, they both came by their food dishonestly. After all, they stole it. And they hypocritically asked if there was anyone there who owned it. We're making sure that nobody could hear them. And also they thought of themselves as virtuous because they hadn't done the killing. Somebody else had killed the iguana and the fish. They thought, oh, I'm so virtuous, I didn't kill anything. And also they told the holy man, this is my food, this is my place. So they were implying a great sacrifice on their part in giving it away, when actually there was no problem at all in finding it. And the monkey was even lazier. All he had to do was stretch out an arm and pick a fruit out of the tree. So the hare is definitely contrasted with these. He's rather different. Giving was something that the hare desperately wanted to do. He was really keen. How can I do this? I really want to give. You know, how can I do this? And he saw it as a great magical spell, giving. He saw it as a rite in alchemy, giving. a rite of transmutation in the flames. He saw the flames represent transformation. So it's as if he saw, I can change myself completely by giving, like the way that stone can be changed into gold in the flames by an alchemist. And he said to himself, I will just give myself. I don't have anything else. I'll just give myself. I'll give myself up. He says, I'll give up any feelings of personal virtue, any feelings of mine, even my body. I'll forget about all those ideas. I'll just give myself. So he took this leap into the flames. And when he did that, he invented something. He invented the Bodhisattva ideal. This is this idea that came to him was, in a way, the sense of giving up, giving yourself up as the Bodhisattva ideal. Something completely new, something unprecedented entered the world. A great leap of imagination. Now the world the hare lived in was one of being very pious, being virtuous in a conventional way. So they all said, the full moon is here, we must do our celebration, how do you do it? You're supposed to give things to people. And they were trying to sort of follow the rules. But the hare came up with a new invention. It was a radical generosity erupting into the world. And in fact, it's interesting that the act that he took threatened the highest seat of mundane power. It was so strong. So the idea is that the seat, the throne that the king of the gods sat on, became red hot. Why did it become red hot? Because what the hare was doing was going beyond the mundane. He was saying he was going beyond the ordinary world. And in Buddhism, chakra represents, or the king of the gods represents, the top of ordinariness, of the mundane. Like in other religions, God may represent otherness and the transcendental, but in Buddhism, the king of the gods represents just the most powerful being who is still within this world of samsara, unenlightened. So his throne was threatened by the hare's action. Now, at first, the impulse was only an idea, so he had to have a chance to act on it, and he rises to the challenge. And he pauses only to shed the parasitic remnants of his lower nature, those little fleas, you see, that he decided that he would save them and not get them burnt. Which I think of those fleas as being all the little worries, all the little wants and desires that we have, all the little reservations we have. He said, no, get rid of those, and then I'll jump into the fire. And he leapt from his cozy, secure home, in the bushes, in the wood, into the transmuting flames. And he expected that this would be very difficult. He expected pain. He expected to be destroyed and roasted by this experience. But actually he was wrong. And it says in the story that he felt like a swan landing amongst the red lotus flowers in a lake. So he didn't feel any pain, as it turned out. He didn't feel any problem with the whole thing. And it may be that when we have a noble impulse of some kind, what is painful is the hesitation. What is painful there is, oh no, I can't do that, I can't give that away. That's my favourite CD, I can't do that, no. And there is the pain that you're burnt, but you're burnt only because of that hesitation, in a sense, perhaps. We talked about that in the group this morning, I think. So we might get scorched by the tension between the old habits and the new habits. But once we've really gone for it, I don't think we do get burnt. Once you take the plunge, you find that you've already changed. The flames of transmutation become part of you. They don't hurt you at all. That reminds me of a story I heard about Jean Cocteau, the French filmmaker. And he was being interviewed by a journalist. And the journalist had a list of questions, you know, the standard questions that say, what is your next project? And, you know, what is your favourite colour? And all that kind of thing. And the journalist had in one of his list of questions said, if your house was burning down, what one object would you rescue from the flames? And Jean Cocteau said to the journalist, he said, I would rescue the flames. So the fire itself is valuable. It's a transforming thing, isn't it? So this hare, this little hare, took a leap into the flames, and this leap was a leap on the Bodhisattva path. He leaps towards becoming a Buddha in that direction. And according to the story, the world was permanently changed by this action because the moon changed its appearance. So there's a change happens in the world, this act of complete generosity. The portrait appears on the moon, this lofty, shining, beautiful, ever-changing moon. Until that moment, it was just white, with nothing on it at all. But after that, a picture was etched with this crimson, red fluid squeezed from the depths of the rocky earth, this red-hot volcanic lava going from the depths of the earth to the very height of the moon, etching, painting this picture of the hair on the moon. So when the Buddha tells this as a story, in a way he's talking symbolically in the form of a fable, about how he discovered that he could go beyond himself. Maybe he's thinking of a previous life. Maybe in a way he's trying to explain what happened to him just a few years before. And maybe it's a way of him doing that. He remembers himself in the past taking a great leap of imagination and a great leap of self-transcendence, transcending himself. So he starts the Bodhisattva path. And the Bodhisattva path, according to Buddhist tradition, starts with generosity. Dana is the very first step you take. And it's something that everybody can do in their own way. Giving is always possible. And giving is what takes you beyond self-concern. That's why it's the first step of the Bodhisattva path. If you genuinely give something, it's so liberating. It's just really fabulous. We feel the hesitation. We don't want to do it in some ways. But when it happens, we just feel great. It's just so liberating, expanding. And it's always possible. Now, why is it a hare in the story? I think the hare is very appropriate. I'll just tell you a little bit why I think the hare is such an appropriate hero for this story. The hare leaps. But there are other reasons as well. The hare is a magic animal. Usually the hare is regarded as she, as female, in England at least. And she is completely unpredictable. She excels in the unexpected. I don't know if this has ever happened to you, but sometimes in England I've walked across an empty field. There's nothing in the field at all. And then suddenly this brown shape goes whoosh, and zooms away across the field at very, very high speed. They run so fast, it's amazing. And it gives you the shock of your life. I don't know if there are any stories about hares in Sweden, but in England I've heard lots and lots of stories about hares. For example, some people hunt hares in England, and when a pack of dogs is chasing the hare will sometimes do completely unexpected things. For example, on one occasion, there was a big pack of dogs all barking, chasing the hare, getting closer and closer, the hare was running away, and then suddenly the hare stood still and jumped over the dogs. And the dogs were so surprised by this, they started fighting each other. And the hare was able to run away and escape. And according to the legends, which are, well, in March, in spring, we talk about the March hare, the mad March hare in England. Because in March, in the breeding season, the hares go completely crazy. They race up and down the fields, they fight with each other, and they jump over things, they jump bounding up and down in the air as if they're completely mad. And they're regarded as moonstruck hares. And they play as well. In Belfast Airport, you know, in Northern Ireland, the hares all wait until a plane is about to take off. And then they race the plane, see if they can run faster than the plane. So you get these groups of maybe 20 hares all running along as fast as they can, trying to go faster than the aeroplane. But usually they don't live in groups. Usually the hare is solitary, an animal of the open ground. It never uses a hole in the ground. It's always on the alert. Its ears are always pricked up. It's always listening very hard. It's got all-round vision. Its eyes are on the side of its head, so it can see behind it as well as in front of it. And according to legend in England, it's still thought nowadays in some country places that the hare can change its gender, change its sex at will. From female to male, or from male to female. And the hare is the familiar of witches. So in English legend, the witch often has a hare with her. She's a trickster. She's the mischievous benefactor of humanity. So you get the tale, a lot of tales from Africa about the hare. I don't know if you've come across the tales called Brer Rabbit, which came from Africa over to America. And it's not really a rabbit, it's a hare in these stories. Also in Native American tales, the hare is the trickster as well, playing everybody tricks. So I think the leaping hare, it really captures my imagination. So imagine a bodhisattva being like that, being like a hare. Imagine yourself being like that, being spontaneous, living a life of play all the time, being unpredictable. So even you don't know what you're going to do next because you're so unpredictable. And this is what you have to be. If you want to be a bodhisattva, you have to start moving in that direction. The bodhisattva hare has to jump out of the realm of stories and fables into the reality of the world. Because without that image of the hare, without that spontaneity, that unpredictability, the world will never change. If we carry on doing things in the old way, nothing will work. We won't change and the world won't change. You need something unpredictable. You need a lot of imagination, I think. If you try to lead the Buddhist life, you must occasionally have like a lightning flash of something new occurring to you. You know, maybe your meditation is okay. Maybe you get on all right with other people. But maybe you say, well, there's no fireworks. You know, it's just getting a bit boring. Maybe your work is just routine. Maybe your practice just means you put the record on again with maybe an occasional nice feeling. And if somebody says, how are you? You say, well, I'm all right. But maybe that means that we've become immune to the unpredictable. Everything is too safe. Everything is too predictable. And we never are surprised by anything. We're still living in the undergrowth. We're living in the bushes, in the wood. We're not coming out into the open. We're not having any new imaginative ideas. But actually, like when you sit down to meditate, anything could happen. Absolutely anything could happen. It's not predictable, really. It's only if we make it that, if we shut ourselves off from possibilities, that it becomes predictable. So if you could imagine every meditation sit being really fresh, being really open to the unexpected. Because every single moment, not just in meditation, but every moment is completely new. This moment is new, and so is this one, and this one, and this one, and this one. They're all new. And you can say, when you sit down to meditate, for example, or when you start a new day, you can say, well, never mind how I'm feeling now, never mind what the last meditation was like, never mind what my life is like at the moment, here it is, now, I'm sitting here now, anything could happen. So it's great if you can say, I'm not going to shut off from that, I'm going to be open to that, anything could happen. And the same is true with other people. I mean, for myself, I must say a lot of the time I just play it safe with other people. I don't leave the door open in case Harlequin might walk in or some strange clown figure might come in because my door is not really open a lot of the time. And I think to myself, well, I mean, I'm not suggesting I'm going to climb into the oven and become a roast dinner, but I could be a little bit more unpredictable, a bit more extravagant, maybe in giving to the people I encounter. I'm too sensible, I think. I'm too reasonable. I'm too cautious. The Austrian philosopher Wittgenstein says, never stay up in the barren heights of cleverness, but come down into the green valleys of being silly. Which is a very unusual thing for a philosopher to say, I think. And he didn't always live up to it, but it's a good piece of advice, I think. Sometimes you need to be silly. I'll just give you one example of this, which is a little bit of a confession, but sometimes I do surprise myself with some notion. And once, a long time ago, a very close friend of mine, I admired him very much, and he moved to Spain to help get a new project going in Spain. And I always used to say, oh, I don't like going abroad. You know, abroad, it's all the same. I don't like it there. But I had this sudden notion, I thought to myself, I could just up sticks, as they say, you can, you know, leave everything behind, I could go to Spain and I could give him a hand, I could help him with what he's doing. But then as soon as I thought that all these all these niggling little concerns came in, you know, but what about this? And I thought, I had reservations, I had anxieties, and so I never did it. And I thought, no, it would just be silly to do that. It would be silly. So I wouldn't allow myself to be silly. So I don't know if you've ever had that, where maybe a really radical little plan starts to form in your mind. Something that would be very, very different, would take you really far beyond your usual idea of yourself. But I think it's a shame if you're like I was then with my friend in Spain and you just let it pass. And you think, oh, well, just let it pass. Never mind. Forget about it and carry on as before. So at first, the radical idea might look as just as stupid as jumping into the middle of a bonfire. You know, what could be more stupid than that? But maybe it's not so stupid. If I actually do it, if I do it, the death, the burning has already happened. It's now in the past, and I'm fine. And the flames turn out to be cool. I expect them to be horrible, but actually it's fine. And I'm just surrounded by flames, which is really nice. Because fire is, of course, a symbol of initiation. The process of dying in order to be reborn is symbolized by burning in the fire. So I think I need the hair to help me with my practice. I think I need this hair to show me how to respond to other people without being too cautious, without being too sensible all the time. And I think it's not just me that needs the hair. I think Buddhism needs the hair as well. I think Vebeve needs the hair. Every so often, we need something just leaping in, something erupting from another dimension, something that is so astonishing that even the Buddha could never have predicted what it was going to be. Only unpredictable interventions can ensure that the Dharma will survive. The Dharma has to be fresh. It has to be real all the time. It can't just be a fossil. It can't just be a book that is preserved from 2,000 years ago. It must respond to the reality of now, and the reality of now is different from the reality of the past. It mustn't settle down to a future of erosion and neglect. Like, you know, like one of these statues I sometimes see in the middle of a town, there's a statue. Once upon a time, this was an important person. Once upon a time, everyone thought they were wonderful, but now it's just crumbling, bits are falling off, the birds are shitting on it, and it's forgotten. Nobody knows why it's there anymore, and eventually it'll just get taken away. It'd be a great shame if Buddhism was like that, I think. All the time, Buddhism is fossilizing. Naturally, this is what happens. It becomes fixed. It becomes full of fixed ideas and fixed doctrines, like corpses from which the spirit has fled. Frozen rituals, frozen traditions that are just kept on ice. And the reason they're frozen is because people are afraid of spiritual heat and warmth and flames, because they think we might get burnt if we do that. If we get too enthusiastic or too excited, oh no, we might get burnt. So we better be careful. Even emotional warmth, I think we're afraid of. So I said that we need, or I need the hair for my own practice. We need the hair for our practice. We need the hair for how we relate to each other. I think also the Dharma needs the hair, as I've said, so it'll keep on being renewed. Maybe you could go even further than this and say that the world needs the hair. The welfare of humanity needs the hair as well. Without the magical influence of something unexpected, something bigger, the transcendental, the world itself will decay. Our world is threatened by decay and destruction. Decay, because if we let things slide, if we spend our time just trying to grope, trying to reach for what is not really the best, if we try to reach always for our own self-interest, for all these painkillers of stimulation and possessions, if that's what we're really going for all the time, if that's where our energy goes, then I think the world itself is decaying. And the world is threatened by destruction. We all know about this. It's threatened by destruction, by starvation and deprivation, by pollution, global warming, by conflict, warfare, all these things, because there isn't this unpredictable element strong enough in the world of people who are prepared to risk jumping into the fire. Now, personally, I think the world of humanity can survive. I don't think it's doomed. but not through any specific answers. It's not you just have to find the solution. This is the solution. Do this, do this, do this. Not through any political solution, not through any moral solution, not through any religious solution. I don't think this is what's needed. Not through a return to old values either, whatever that means. I think what we do to survive is to move on. You and me and other people leaping over boundaries, leaping over limitations. That's how the world survives. We need to be hares, I think. Generosity and unpredictability, those are the two things that we need, I think. And if we keep leaping, then whatever influence we have will be an effective influence, a lasting influence, whether it's just the personal influence on the people we meet, or whether it's a wider social influence in the way we live our life. So do I have to really look to other people to decide what I do with my life? Do I need to follow other people's rules and other people's patterns that other people have laid down? Can't I just sit quietly sometimes and allow some unexpected impulse to arise? Let it, give it the space to be there. And see that it's an impulse that takes me outside myself. Something dangerous, something exciting, something fresh. And then when that impulse has come up, then leap like the hare leaping into the fire. So, always to remind us of this, this is maybe in the future, you might even remember this. When you see the full moon, you look very carefully and you can see the hare in the full moon. Sangharakshita writes about the Jataka stories, including the hare Jataka. He says how they illustrate how the urge to enlightenment is imminent in all forms and spheres of life, from the humblest to the highest, and it manifests whenever a kind or intelligent action is performed. So the urge to enlightenment, the bodhicitta, is there in all forms of life, even animals, even literally in animals. It's there in us at our worst as well as at our best. And this urge, this bodhicitta, is manifesting every time we perform a kind action, every time we perform an intelligent action, every time anybody does so, the bodhicitta is appearing. I think it's very inspiring, confidence-inspiring thought to realize that. A kind and intelligent action is the leap of the hare. It takes you beyond a narrow concern for yourself. And I'm glad to say that there are kind and intelligent actions everywhere. We've seen it today and yesterday here, and I'm sure we all see it in our lives a lot. The bodhisattva principle is turning up wherever you look. It just means letting go, giving away, letting go of an outdated sense of a vulnerable, tiny, hard selfhood. So I think the story of the hare gives you an idea, gives you like a mythic idea of what self-transcendence is like. It's just a story, it's just an image. And you can find the same image, the same kind of story in poetry. And I'll finish with some Buddhist devotional poetry from Shantideva's Bodhicaryavatara, which is where our puja comes from. So you may recognize parts of this in the puja, written by Shantideva. He lived 1,200 years ago in India. And I'll finish with this. So I'm just going to read this part out, and I think we'll have the same, of a similar part of the Bodhicaryavatara in Swedish in the puja as well. So listen out for that. This is what Shantideva says. May the merit gained in my acting thus go to the alleviation of the suffering of all beings. May I be the medicine for the sick. May I be their physician and their servant until sickness no longer arises. With rains of food and drink, may I dispel the anguish of hunger and thirst. In great famines, may I myself change into food and drink. May I be an imperishable treasury for needy beings. My personality throughout my existences, my possessions, and my merit in all three ways, I give up without regard to myself. I would be a protector for those without protection, a leader for those who journey, and a boat, a bridge, a passage for those desiring to reach the further shore. For all creatures, I would be an island for those who seek an island, a lantern for those desiring a lantern, a bed for those who wish to rest. I would be a slave for those desiring a slave. I would be, for all creatures, a magic jewel, an inexhaustible jar, a powerful spell, a universal remedy, a wishing tree, a cow of plenty. Just as the earth and other elements are serviceable in many ways to the infinite number of beings inhabiting limitless space, so may I become that which maintains all beings situated throughout space, so long as all have not attained to peace. Thank you.